Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from the economist James Galbraith of the University of Texas on why all this deficit hysteria is so, so wrong. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Matt Taibbi, making his fifth appearance on this show. He was in Behind the News long before the world ever heard the phrase, great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. Before that, some comments on the news. Actually, what follows is adapted from a piece in the brand new issue of the newsletter I edit, Left Business Observer. The economic recovery persists, such as it is, with employment continuing to grow modestly and unemployment continuing to work itself down from the disastrous to the merely painful. But the real action now is in the massive hysteria to cut the deficit. What is this hysteria based on? You can't find any basis for it in the projections for the next decade by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO. The strategy is instead to look at the current numbers and scream. But what about those current numbers? Yes, the federal deficit has been big for the last few years, in the range of 9 to 10% of GDP, which is very high by historical standards. It hit 30% of GDP in the middle of World War II, but between 1971 and 2008, it averaged just 2.5% of GDP and never broke above 6%. But the Great Recession brought the red ink to record levels, four times the modern average, as revenues collapsed and spending on income support, bailouts, and stimulus ballooned. But deficits have remained large despite the recovery that began in late 2009. In fact, we're getting close to 2 years since the end of the recession. Why these persisting deficits? For one, job growth has been very slow, meaning that tax receipts continue to be sluggish. On top of that, revenues have been reduced by the extension of the Bush tax cuts, along with the addition of a 2 percentage point cut in Social Security taxes that was part of the Obama-Congress tax deal at the end of last year. And on the expenditure side, spending on those dreaded entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, the unholy trinity in mainstream discourse, are pushing higher. Still, the tax reductions contribute twice as much as spending increases of all kinds, not just the unholy trinity, to the deficit over the next couple of years. Lingering effects of the recession are also boosting the deficit. Spending on so-called automatic stabilizers, like unemployment insurance and food stamps, expands in a downturn. These help keep the economy afloat, but they do cost money. The slow recovery means that such spending persists. The CBO estimates that without such stabilizers, the deficit would be closer to 7% of GDP than the 9% it's likely to be this year. The deficit should shrink as the stabilizers recede in importance. Oh, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are likely to cost about $160 billion this year, 1% of GDP. Add to that the waning cost of the stimulus package, another 1% of GDP, and the tax cuts, about 3% of GDP, and you've got almost 5% of GDP, or close to half this year's likely deficit. Throw in the stabilizers, another 2% of GDP, and you've explained two-thirds of this year's deficit. But these expenditures, which have nothing to do with the maligned entitlements, are being used as an excuse to go after Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. These mostly temporary costs, though in the case of the wars you can only hope that they're temporary, are being used to create a hysteria that longer-term budget protections couldn't support. For the 2013-16 period, the CBO estimates that deficit without stabilizers will average 2.8% of GDP, or 3.3% with them. Both figures are considerably less than the deficits of the Reagan years, and not all that much larger than the modern average. In other words, if the recovery continues, deficits over the next several years are nothing to worry about. There is no fiscal emergency. And cutting the budget wildly, as if there were a fiscal emergency, would almost certainly derail the recovery, see Britain and Ireland, which are experiencing this right now. This would create the crisis it was meant to avoid. Looking a few years further out, the numbers are no more alarming. The CBO forecasts the deficit will average 3.1% of GDP from 2017 to 2021, a decline from the previous five-year period. Of course, these projections assume that the economy doesn't fall apart again. And what about those dreaded entitlements? A parenthetical note on that word, entitlements. They're benefits to which one is entitled by right. The word is useful for propaganda purposes because of the scent of narcissistic greed about it. But in budget terms, you qualify, you get it. Congress doesn't have to renew these programs every year. They're on autopilot to keep serving the constituency they serve at constant levels of provision. To explain them is to explain why the right hates them. Benefits, if they exist at all, should be mean and tightly regulated. Back to the CBO projections. They project that between 2010 and 2021, social spending on Social Security will rise by 0.5% of GDP, Medicare by 0.7, and Medicaid by 0.6. Taken together, that's less than 3% of GDP. Not trivial, but not a crisis either. But Medicare also collects premiums from its beneficiaries, offsetting receipts in budget jargon. Net of those, Medicare spending will rise by just 0.5% of GDP. Other mandatory spending, meaning money that will have to be spent automatically without requiring yearly congressional approval, is actually slated to fall. All forms of mandatory spending, the unholy trinity plus the rest, net of offsetting receipts, is slated to rise by all of 1% of GDP over the next decade. So end the wars and roll back Bush's tax cuts, and you can fund that increase three times over. Ditto if you take the Pentagon back to its spending levels when Clinton left the White House. Over the very long term, 30, 40 years, the rising costs of Medicare and Medicaid, assuming they go on as they've been, will get burdensome. But these are just visible parts of our entire crisis of healthcare finance, problems that Obamacare, should it survive, can't address. Hacking away at them, and Paul Ryan's honest budget plan, as people like to call it, would solve the Medicare problem by forcing beneficiaries to double their out-of-pocket spending from current levels, and won't fix the underlying problem. But there's no better way to avoid a serious discussion than by creating hysteria. Back to have a serious discussion that's an antidote to hysteria with James Galbraith after this musical break. That was some of Fight the Cuts, a 1982 song by the Mekons. I'm not sure what the lyrics say, but they do sound righteous and appropriate to what follows. My first guest is James Galbraith, usually known as Jamie, who teaches economics and policy at the University of Texas. Jamie's a pretty hardcore Keynesian. I have some problems with his position, which I'll outline after the interview, but I'll let him have his say first. Jamie Galbraith. We're in the midst of a fiscal panic. Just the other day, rating agency Standard & Poor's put the U.S. on a watch list for possible downgrading. What do you make of the Standard & Poor's move?
It was laughable. It was not something that you can begin to take seriously. Standard & Poor's has a responsibility to offer credit ratings on credit risk, which is the risk that an entity is going to default. Not pay its debts. And this is not something that can happen to the United States government. The United States government owes its debts in dollars, and it is obligated by law and under the Constitution to honor them, and it will do so. So people will get paid off as the bonds come due, as they have since the beginning of the Republic. After that came out, and Standard & Poor's started to say, well, this was what people associated with it. This was a matter of investment risk, a matter of rising inflation rates or a falling exchange rate or a higher interest rates and their effect on long-term bonds. But if that were in fact the case, that criticism, which Standard & Poor's is in no way competent to make, those risks, to assess those risks, those risks apply equally to privately issued bonds, corporate bonds, municipals, bonds issued by other sovereign borrowers in U.S. dollars would all be subjected to the same kind of risk. But S&P did not say that they were issuing a downgrade warning on bonds issued by anybody except the U.S. government.
Well, was it some sort of political move, do you think?
It's impossible for me to characterize what their motives were, so I won't. But it was incompetent, however you describe it.
And this from an agency that hadn't distinguished itself in the recent credit bubble, was it?
Well, yeah, there is a problem with the record of the ratings agencies. They rated vast quantities of mortgage-backed paper as AAA when it was all junk, and they refused to look at the underlying documentation that would have demonstrated to them that it was junk. They were at one point useful in rating corporate bonds, but they missed the major corporate frauds of the early part of the past decade as well. And they have not been good on sovereign debt either, downgrading the various European countries just a few days before major troubles erupted, or even afterwards. So it's unclear why the ratings agencies continue to be a force in the marketplace beyond the fact that they have a legally recognized status, which really is a big problem at the moment, because it kind of immunizes them from the consequences of not being very competent at what they do.
Regardless of their competence or standing to make these sorts of judgments, they are reflecting anxieties in the financial markets and among our political, at least portions of our political class, that we're in the midst of some sort of debt crisis. People talk about we're a future Greece or a future Portugal or something like that. What do you make of these cries of alarm?
Well, you're right. The cries are everywhere. We're being overwhelmed by a wave of hysteria on this issue. I tend to think that beyond this is a long-standing effort to cut into Social Security and Medicare, and that we will see that effort come to a climax with the upcoming battle over the debt ceiling. This is all very unfortunate, because Social Security is one of the few remaining mainstays that keeps a large part of the American population protected from poverty, Medicare. Likewise, and while there is a health care cost issue, neither Social Security nor Medicare pose a financial threat to the government or to the country at large. So what we're seeing here is the directing of a great deal of anxiety and many repeated talking points at a very clearly defined political objective.
Let's talk some about why the deficit has been so large now and in recent years. Just to hear some people talk, it's because of liberal profligacy run amok. But let's decompose the causes of the current deficit.
Well, the major reason why the deficit rose dramatically after 2008 was the collapse of the banking system. And collapse of the banking system led to a sharp decline in economic activity and a sharp decline in tax revenues. That's the principal reason for adverse movement of the deficit. A second reason is that when you have falling real GDP, the existing stock of debt grows in relation to GDP. So those are two major reasons. Then, in addition to that, it is true that there is a certain increase in government expenditure on unemployment insurance and food stamps and disability payments and other things that are a consequence of the crisis. But those things help to stabilize people's incomes and to prevent the economic downturn from being even worse than it would otherwise be.
And, of course, there's a stimulus package, but that is now waning as a force, isn't it?
It was not a very large force to begin with, and it is now waning, with the result that states and localities, which relied heavily on the stimulus money to prevent cuts in public education and health care, are now cutting ferociously at those, again, mainstays of the American social system.
And before getting back to the fiscal question, or the longer-term fiscal question, now that the federal stimulus package is waning and we're seeing cutbacks at the state and local level, what is the overall fiscal effect of the government on the economy now?
Well, on the whole, I think it is still supporting the economy because of the effect of these automatic stabilizers, lower tax revenues, and the increased support for people's incomes. But that level of support is much less. It's diminishing, and therefore it's tending to underpin a slower rate of recovery and expansion.
Now, returning to the longer-term questions, what has everyone, I think the people who are alarmed are alarmed about, is long-term projections of a hugely rising debt to GDP ratio for the United States. It's now the highest it's been since the end of World War II, but for the special factors you just mentioned. But the longer-term issues, are we facing anything like a budget emergency, just accepting the official numbers, in the coming years?
Well, to begin with, the debt in the hands of the public is not higher than it has been since the end of World War II. In 1946, it was over 120% of GDP, and it stayed higher than present levels, which I think are around 74% of GDP, well into the mid-late 1950s. So we're in fact experiencing levels of debt to GDP which are not historically abnormal at all. Are we facing a crisis of the ability of the American government to fund itself? No, and in the nature of things, so long as the United States functions and the citizenry uses dollars and is willing to hold dollar assets, the United States government cannot face an operational problem of financing public spending. We're not going to run into a situation where where the interest rate on U.S. government debt gets forced up. The interest rate will be set by the Federal Reserve at the levels that the Federal Reserve thinks prudent. And of course, the Federal Reserve can raise interest rates, but it can't be forced to do so against its will.
Well, the Fed can set short-term rates, but what influence does it have over longer-term rates?
There is no need for the United States government to finance itself with longer-term securities. If it needed to, it can finance itself entirely with short-term securities at the rate the Federal Reserve sets. So there's no reason to think that the U.S. debt, the interest paid on the United States government debt, needs to be. Or will be forced up to some extraordinary level. And indeed, one of the problems with the projections that underlie the scenarios for an exploding public deficit debt to GDP ratio is the assumption, which is embedded in the CBO's forecast, that short-term interest rates will rise by about 4.5 percentage points between now and, let's say, 4 or 5 years from now, even though the same CBO projections do not show any increase in the inflation rate. Once you push the interest rate up past the rate of economic growth, of course, the debt to GDP ratio rises and it begins to rise exponentially. But it's an entirely artificial construct based upon the way in which they constructed their computer programs. There's no reason to believe the Federal Reserve would actually do that, and certainly no economic reason why they should.
Now, is there any scenario under which that projection of really sharply increasing real short-term interest rates would make sense?
Well, if you had rapidly rising inflation, then you can expect it's likely that the Federal Reserve would react to that by raising interest rates. But by the same token, if you had rapidly rising inflation, you would have a rapidly rising nominal GDP, and the ratio of debt to GDP would not rise so rapidly or might even decline. So what's not possible is to have this scenario, at least it's not extremely implausible to have this scenario in which the Federal Reserve irrationally pushes up the short-term interest rate while the inflation rate stays where it is. Why the CBO puts this in their forecast, I don't know. I suspect it's a fairly mechanical process that they have over there, that macroeconomic forecasting has not been traditionally a high-level activity. It's not really necessary that they have a consistent or plausible macro forecast. Their job mainly is to have a baseline that they use for all legislative proposals in terms of costing out what the budget impact of those proposals are. But the fact is, people have seized upon this particular forecast as though it were some kind of a plausible economic future, which it is not.
Speaking with Jamie Galbraith of the University of Texas, let's just review some of the standard rationales for hysteria. One is that the United States has a very low savings rate and is unable to finance its own budget deficit domestically and relies very heavily on foreign, meaning mostly Chinese, money. What's your reaction to that?
Well, in the first place, the private savings rate of American households rose dramatically with the crisis. It rose absolutely in line with the rise in the public budget deficit, and for a very simple reason. The public budget deficit is the accounting counterpart of private savings. So when tax revenues fell and public spending rose, private households had more income in relation to what they were giving back to the government in taxes, and they stashed it away as savings. That's mechanical. Secondly, with respect to what happens with foreigners, with the Chinese and others, the Chinese only can accumulate U.S. debt to the extent that they sell to us more than they buy from us in return, to the extent that we run a deficit in our trade account. So the scale of the budget deficit as such really has is only very indirectly related to the Chinese accumulation of U.S. Treasury securities. But then the question is, why should we be concerned about the ownership of U.S. Treasury securities? Basically, all investors have the same motivations. They will hold securities of the United States or other countries if it is a convenience for them to do so, and if they find that, you know, advantageous. And it's not, there's no strong reason why the Chinese or anybody else would behave differently from our own domestic holders of U.S. Treasury securities. And in general, they don't. The only thing I can think of that really makes foreign official holders a little bit different is that they tend to prefer public securities that are liquid and have no default risk, so they tend to hold more treasuries than let's say, corporate bonds. But that's, again, why we should complain about that, I can't imagine.
And another official worry is that the debt service is becoming a larger and larger portion of government spending, and that crowds out more elevated pursuits.
I'm skeptical that that's true. In the forecast, debt service is supposed to balloon as a share of government expenditure. But there again, there is an inconsistency in the projections. If it were true that debt service rose to 15, 20, 25% of GDP, and then that driving the very large projected deficits in the future, then, of course, those payments of net interest on U.S. government bonds are government spending. They are an income to the private sector. They would result in private spending, and you can't possibly imagine ballooning private incomes by that amount without having a large effect on total expenditure, on economic activity, and on inflation. And so it's not plausible to put in the same projection a vast increase in net interest on government debt as a share of GDP and no effect on GDP itself.
And then the projections that cause so much worry are for ever-rising spending on us baby boomers as we get old and sick and need to retire. First of all, Social Security, that is perceived as a great fiscal burden on the U.S. government. How much of a burden is it, and how much of a burden is it likely to become?
Well, Social Security is a transfer program. Social Security supports at a very modest level the living standards of the elderly population and also of a great number of dependents and survivors. In fact, about a third of Social Security payments don't go to the elderly at all, but rather to younger people who have depended on them. You know, you think about this in economic terms. In what sense is this a burden? If you didn't have the Social Security payments, then elderly people, if they had children, would be coming to their children and asking for support. Elderly people who did not have children, who were willing to or able to support them, did not have children at all, would be ending up in dire straits, and they would be dying younger. I don't see why this is considered to be a desirable social objective. What Social Security does, what the Social Security system does, is to even out the burdens at two levels. At the level of retired population, it says that you're going to be supported based upon your past work contribution and not upon your family status. This is a good thing. Secondly, at the level of the working population, it says you pay the payroll tax whether or not you have your own parents that you would otherwise support. In other words, even if you don't have parents that you're willing or able to support, you pay in and support the elderly population collectively. This, too, is a good thing. It means that the burden on any individual is much less erratic than it would otherwise be. It means that the benefits to older population are much more reliable than they otherwise would be. Is this a burden on the national economy as a whole? I don't see the logic of that statement. It simply says that we're guaranteeing part of our national revenue, part of our national income, to support this segment of the population who presumably we would rather have living in some very modest comfort than living in poverty and dying earlier.
And then the thing that people really worry about is Medicare and Medicaid, that these programs are going to rise and take up an ever larger portion of the federal budget and then presumably start eating us as well. What do you say to those projections?
Well, again, as we have a larger elderly population, then, of course, the medical expenditures on that population will tend to increase. That's normal, and that's what we should be expecting and what we should be preparing for. To the extent, and we do have a major problem with uncontrolled and escalating healthcare costs, that is a problem of the healthcare system as a whole. Just because Medicare is a program for the elderly doesn't mean that it is just to focus the cost reduction measures and the expenditure reduction measures on Medicare, just because it's a program that's run by the government. In fact, it's rather cruel to say that we're going to do cost control for the elderly part of the population, which is covered by Medicare, and not do it for the rest of the population. The only reasonable and just and efficient way to handle the problem of healthcare costs is to tackle it for the healthcare system as a whole. And right now, of course, the other thing that we have going is major reductions in state contributions to Medicaid as a result of the state and local budget crises. And I have to remember that Medicaid serves an indigent elderly population, many of whose members were middle class before they required the long-term care for which Medicaid is paying. What's going to happen to those people? Some of them will end up back with their families as their nursing homes close. This will be a very great burden on their families, and some will end up in emergency rooms occupying hospital beds at much higher per day costs than they were incurring before. So what we're seeing here as the result of a budget-driven crunch in these programs is a movement toward less rather than more rational use of the resources.
And finally, what do you think is driving this deficit hysteria? Are there material interests behind it? Is there an ideological passion? What's the underlying cause?
Well, this has been part of a very longstanding campaign directed principally against the major programs of the New Deal and the Great Society, against Social Security, against Medicare, and against Medicaid. And I think that is a major element in this. I just don't think there's any way you can get around to it. The conversation just comes around repeatedly to these false premises and exaggerated arguments that lie against these programs, which, as I think I've said before, remain enormously important and successful bulwarks of a basic American living standard. So my view is protecting the core programs of the Great Society and the New Deal remains an extraordinarily important goal for this particular political debate. Are there people in the debate who think that they are about saving the Republic from various doomsday scenarios, which we're hearing all the time? I don't doubt that there are people who feel that way, but it's very, very hard, and I have tried and others have tried, to get a clear and coherent explanation out of them of just what exactly the doomsday they imagine is. There are people who think, for example, that the policies that we've been pursuing are going to lead to runaway inflation. There are inflation risks in the environment. Certainly, I think the increasing scarcity and cost of energy is going to place a large part of the economy under severe cost pressure in coming years. But the idea that the that the stimulus package or that the current budget situation of the United States is somehow intrinsically going to lead us toward a high U.S. inflation rate relative to the rest of the world is not one that withstands careful scrutiny. So it's very hard to know exactly what, in many cases, the underlying logic of the argument behind this hysteria actually is. And in most cases, we don't even hear an argument. We simply hear the categorical assertion that the budget position is, quote, unsustainable, unquote. That's a word that's constantly repeated, but again, very, very seldom examined in a serious way to see what, if anything, it's supposed to mean.
Well, in the words of a quote from Ayn Rand, a thinker for our times, I just read, to be free, a man must be free of his brothers.
Well, that is would be a very unfortunate fate for a republic.
That was James Galbraith of the University of Texas. As I said in the intro to this interview, I do have some problems with his position. Basically, my problems boil down to this. He's just too sanguine about debt. Not in the short term. I totally agree that federal debt levels are not a problem for the next few years. But over the long term, debt does matter. The more debt you have, the more vulnerable you are to pressure from your creditors. And we see now what the creditors' priorities are. Cutting social spending. In the short term, using borrowed money to stimulate a weak economy makes sense, but over the longer term, borrowing money from rich people is often a cowardly substitute for taxing them. Adding to the government's vulnerability to a creditor strike is something that Galbraith endorsed, borrowing short term rather than long term. It's a basic principle of finance that you shouldn't borrow short term to fund long term projects. If you have to reborrow every few months, it leaves you open to the risk that you won't be able to roll the old debts over, or that interest rates could rise dramatically. And in the case of the government, the creditors could say, cut Medicare now, and it would have to, or they might not buy the government's bonds. I also think that Galbraith is too sanguine about debt service. He makes it sound like paying interest on treasury bonds is just another form of government spending. But it's an upward redistribution of income, from the middle and upper middle income taxpayers to the very rich who hold the bulk of treasury bonds. That's money that could be better spent on healthcare, education, job creation, high-speed rail, and environmental reconstruction. But as an antidote to deficit hysteria, that was a welcome corrective. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. We'll be back to hear from Matt Taibbi after this musical break.
Listen to the voices drifting through the windows of the grand old villas of Bonn. All the town's dark secrets flow through the Rhineland's river mist. Wives of bankers reminisce in whispers. Debilitated by horrors, half heard, half remembered. All the town's dark secrets, unstable and dangerous.
More Mekons, that's Secrets, from their 1991 album, The Curse of the Mekons. My next guest is Matt Taibbi, a reporter for Rolling Stone, who's become world famous for his definition of Goldman Sachs in an article published a bit over a year ago. As a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. I first got to know Matt when he was living in Moscow, co-editing along with Mark Ames the alternative English language weekly, The Exile. Their beat was reporting on the social collapse that was Yeltsin's Russia. Matt came back to the U.S., founded a paper in Buffalo, did a column for the New York Press, and wrote a terrific book on the 2004 presidential campaign, Spanking the Donkey. Matt is so funny that it's easy to overlook how smart and serious he really is. Matt's got a piece in the April 28 issue of Rolling Stone, looking into just where all those billions that the Federal Reserve handed out in the heat of the financial crisis went. Not many other people are asking a question, even though there are some documents available. What a culture. Matt Taibbi. Welcome, Matt. Let's start by looking at some of the mysteries of the Fed's emergency rescue actions during the financial crisis. I'm speaking as if that's over, but we're not quite sure of that. But in any case, a couple of wives of Morgan Stanley hotshots got money. Who and why?
The backstory on this is that during the debate over the Dodd-Frank bill last year, there was this movement to audit the Fed that got started by Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul and Alan Grayson, and they wanted to audit, you know, get the Fed to open its books for its whole history. They weren't able to get that, but as an amendment to the reform bill, they got the Fed to open its books for this two-year period from the end of 07 to like the middle of 09.
Before going on, just underscore this point. The Fed does pretty much what it wants to without any kind of congressional oversight or audit, right?
Basically, yeah. Certainly, its books are completely closed to Congress. And, you know, it's interesting. You're really the only access Congress has in terms of oversight is that it periodically gets to interview the Fed chairman. And that's pretty much it. And this has been going on since its creation. People have been trying to get the Fed's books opened, and there's been no luck. And even in this case, it was a very limited audit. They got basically a look at emergency lending and some of the bailout programs like the TALF. So it wasn't everything. It wasn't like all the discount window lending and everything else. So, and even the information that they got was incomplete. You know, they how big the loans were, but you didn't know how much people paid for the securities that they gave to the Fed. And so it was very incomplete, but we got a little bit of a picture. And so they published a list of 21,000 transactions, mostly bailout transactions. And on that list, among other things, was a series of loans totaling $220 million to the wives of a couple of Morgan Stanley executives, one of them being Christy Mack, who was the wife of John Mack, who at the time was the CEO of Morgan Stanley. And we were basically trying to sell this story to my editors, trying to get them interested, and we just picked out the craziest name on the list that we could find and said, you know, why is a Morgan Stanley wife getting $220 million in this time when, you know, we're fighting over whether or not we have enough money to pay for NPR and that sort of thing? And so that's what the story is.
And they didn't get his wives. They actually had some kind of financial vehicle that got a loan, right?
Right, yeah. It was the way this worked was, and this is through a program called the TALF, which ostensibly was designed to stimulate consumer lending. These two women were principal investors in a company called Waterfall TALF Opportunity, and that company put up a small stake and got a $220 million loan from the Fed. Then that company went out and bought student loans and commercial mortgages with that money. And the way the TALF was set up, all that stuff you buy, basically what they do is they give you a bunch of money. They say, go out and buy a bunch of securities and give them to us. If they go up in value, you take them back. If they go down in value, you leave them with us and we eat the losses. And that's what they did.
So this wasn't a pre-existing entity that got in trouble. This was created to take money from the Fed and invest it elsewhere.
Exactly, yeah. And that's, you know, that wasn't unusual. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of these of companies that were created specifically to take advantage of this bailout program, the TALF. And it wasn't unique to, you know, to these two women. There were all kinds of crazy names on that list, and everybody was rushing to take advantage of this program, which ended up being expanded to almost $1 trillion. You know, it was initially supposed to be $200 billion, but they ended up issuing almost $1 trillion worth of loans.
And as far as we know, these women hadn't discovered some late-life entrepreneurship. Presumably somebody else was pulling their strings?
Yeah, no, that's what we have to assume. We don't have very many answers in terms of whether or not these women had any expertise or anything like that, but that doesn't seem to be the case. It looks an awful lot like John Mack simply wanted to take advantage of this program, and for whatever reason, he didn't do it in his name. He decided to do it in his wife's name. I mean, that's what it looks like. I obviously don't have any proof of that, but that was what was speculated by a lot of the people that I talked to.
So, and as marvelously scandalous and sensational as this particular transaction is, you found a lot of other interesting stuff going through these 20,000 transactions, right?
Oh, there's just amazing stuff in there. You know, the I would say that the most amazing transactions are the ones that involve foreign central banks or foreign development banks. The people who turned me on to the story were basically from Senator Bernie Sanders' office, and they were pointing out that there were loans to, there was the Bank of Bavaria, the South Korean Development Bank, whose sole purpose is to develop infrastructure in South Korea. And they got billions and billions of dollars. There's a company called ABC, which is the Arab Banking Corporation of Bahrain. That company is 59% owned by the Central Bank of Libya, and they got $35 billion. And some of those loans, it was a number of loans, but some of them were at interest rates as low as 0.25%. And this is what people have to understand about the bailout. The bailout was really not the money that was directly given to these people. The bailout was really the difference between how much it cost for these people to borrow money as opposed to how much it cost for us to borrow money. So in the old days, banks, if they were borrowing on the open market, they would have to borrow at 3 or 3.5%, and then they would lend it out to us at 5% for mortgages or whatever, and that's how they would make their money. Now, with all this cheap money from the Fed, they're borrowing at 0% or 0.5%, and they're lending at 5% still. And that's the bailout. The bailout is that extra 2.5% that all these companies were getting.
Now, the rationale for this was that at that point, the credit system was largely frozen. Banks weren't lending to each other. They weren't lending to consumers or businesses. And the Fed was supposed to be pumping some money into the banks so they would lend to the real world borrowers. But it didn't really work out that way, did it?
Well, in this instance, I think you could probably say that they accomplished their goal, which was their goal was to stimulate consumer lending. The TALF was designed originally because car dealerships were having problems getting financing from the banks. So, you know, we just had the crash in 2008, and the banks are freaked out because the whole world is exploding, so they don't want to lend anybody, even when the loans are safe. So they went to the government and they said, hey, we don't want to lend unless we get a state guarantee for every loan we give out. And so the Fed stepped in. And yeah, no, certainly the program succeeded in stimulating consumer lending, but that's because the Fed threw $1 trillion at the problem. The issue is that they allowed a whole bunch of millionaires and billionaires to step in and get and occupy a government-sponsored role as middlemen in all these transactions, and make risk-free million-dollar commissions on all these transactions, and that's the crazy part that people don't understand.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see a lot of congressional interest in these documents or in the further scrutiny of what went on in the bailout, and I don't see much media reporting on it aside from yours. Am I missing that?
It's the weirdest thing because there are, you know, I'm sure, as you know, there are scads of reporters pouring over the federal budget. I mean, the budget that we actually talk about, you know, where that involves us paying taxes into the Treasury and what we do with that money, everybody's pouring over those numbers. You know, how much do we spend on NPR? How much do we spend on Medicare and Medicaid and other entitlement programs? But these bailout programs are, if anything, they're actually bigger than the federal budget. I mean, depending on whose numbers you're using, it's $5, $6, $7 trillion we're talking about in a 2-year period. So this is a gigantic amount of money, and just this TALF program alone was probably bigger than the defense budget all by itself. And how many people do we have administering these programs? I mean, it can't have been more than a couple of hundred Fed employees. And so, obviously, there was enormous potential for abuse here. There couldn't possibly have been any kind of rational oversight over how this money was given out. And yet, it's you're right, it's really weird. It's like there's no interest at all in who got this money and whether there was any fraud or anything.
Now, you've been talking to a bunch of congressional staff people about this. Do you have any sense of why this lack of interest from the broader body of Congress?
I think that there's a couple of possible explanations. One is, look, the Fed, the relationship between the Fed and Wall Street is incredibly close and intertwined, and most of these major Wall Street companies are basically living at the pleasure of the Fed. I think if you looked at the top Wall Street banks, you know, Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, you know, Morgan Stanley, they would all be bankrupt and out of business right now had it not been for their access to the discount window and to the emergency lending in 2008. And I think it's something where that these people, that, you know, these major campaign contributors on Wall Street, are staunchly opposed to there being any more opening of the Fed's books, because it would reveal to the public the extent to which these Wall Street companies are essentially quasi-public institutions that have been relying on federal support. So my sense is that that's probably where a lot of the reluctance is coming from, that these companies that are major campaign contributors to politicians on both parties don't want people kind of opening up that can of worms, because it's, once you start looking at this, there's really no end to it. I mean, it's really just appalling, and that's the only explanation I can come up with.
It's remarkable that, you know, at this time when our political superiors are dying to cut Medicare and Social Security and break teachers' unions, they can spend trillions like this with no scrutiny.
Right. Yeah. No. That's really the amazing thing about this is, you know, they created this TALF program, and within a year or so, $1 trillion goes out the window, and who's even watching it? Part of this program, the way it was designed, the TALF, if the securities that these people bought lost money, then the first losses were actually going to come out of the pocket, not of the Fed, but of the Treasury. It would come out of the TARP. So there was some oversight, very limited oversight, by the SIGTARP, which is the Special Inspector General for the TARP program.
Now, that guy actually had some nerve, didn't he?
Yeah, no, Borofsky, he was great, but he couldn't really get access to all the documents that, you know, all the numbers in the TALF program. I mean, he got the same numbers that all of us got when the Fed released all this data, and so he doesn't know, for instance, whether there was fraud that went on with any of these transactions or whether there was insider trading. Again, there's an enormous potential for abuse with this program. Just think about what went on. The government basically announces that it's going to put $1 trillion out there in the market to buy up distressed securities, right? So what's to stop a major bank going out, buying up a bunch of crappy securities, right, and then going through a third party, which goes to the government and creates some company specifically to take advantage of this program, and then have them go out and buy these securities at a markup? And this is a con that everybody was telling me was probably going on a grand scale, but we can't check to see if that happened, because the Fed has not released any data about how much we paid for any of this collateral. So there was really no oversight about this enormous expenditure of money. It's just crazy.
I'm speaking with Matt Taibbi, who is a writer for Rolling Stone magazine, and I'm guessing now that enough time is passing that we can pretty much forget about that ever happening.
Well, no, and even that one regulator, you know, Borofsky of SIGTARP, they've pushed him out. He was the one sort of a guy who was really aggressive about trying to look for all this stuff, and the writing on the wall now is that they're going to replace him with somebody who's more of a fellow traveler and is not going to be as aggressive. So there just isn't a whole lot of room in the regulatory structure for investigating any of this, because nobody really has purview over the Fed except for the Fed. So unless there's another act of Congress, we won't have any way of finding out what's going to go on.
Of course, one of the reasons for that is that the Fed is entirely self-financing. It doesn't need to get any money out of Congress, so Congress has no leverage over it.
Right. It doesn't have any leverage over it whatsoever. Although, again, you know, there was some taxpayer money at risk in some of these programs. You know, the Fed designed programs like the TALF and the TAF, and they did slightly draw upon the TARP monies. So there should theoretically be some oversight, but, you know, it didn't really happen that way. The GAO and the SIGTARP were, you know, basically rebuffed when they tried to investigate these things.
And now we happen to be talking on a day on which, as Gawker put it in a headline, one rich guy finally convicted for mortgage meltdown. And this is Lee Farkas, the former head of the mortgage lender Taylor, Bean & Whitaker, convicted on 14 counts of fraud for a almost $3 billion thing that went on for several years. He is the only one, though, it seems, while Angelo Muzzillo and Dick Fold and all these other guys are still breathing free, huh?
Yeah, no, that's really an amazing story, because what happened during the mortgage bubble, there was such rampant criminality, And it wasn't just, you know, the way they pitch it in the media is, well, occasionally there were a few unscrupulous brokers here and there who got people into bad loans. Like, no, that's really not the way it was. It was really a massive systematic effort at criminal fraud and predatory lending that had the assent of the highest executives in companies like Countrywide and New Century. And from there, also the banks that were subsidizing those companies, you know, people forget that there was a very intimate relationship between companies like Countrywide and New Century and banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. And yet there really hasn't been any investigation at all. I mean, they nearly destroyed the entire economy, and they left us in a situation where millions of people are in foreclosure. And, you know, what, you get one person going to jail? I mean, compare that to the savings and loan crisis when, you know, 2,000 people were prosecuted, and there's really been nothing.
And that was far smaller. It seemed big at the time, but that was pretty small beer compared to this.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, the SNL crisis was huge for its time, but it was nothing. It was a drop in the bucket compared to this mortgage business, and really, there's been no effort at any level to really go after the perpetrators of these frauds. And again, it was really a systematic thing. On the ground level, you had these guys who were trying to get essentially mostly poor and often minority borrowers to get into bad loans. You know, people who've qualified for fixed loans, they got them into adjustable rate loans instead. They phonied income statements. They used whiteout in some of the loan applications to try to and falsified information. In fact, in New Century, there was apparently a ritual when a new loan broker came on the job that would buy him his first box of whiteout. That was kind of like your frat initiation. It's because he had to falsify so many documents. And again, yeah, you know, Mozilla, he got fined a little bit of money, but he's walking around free and nobody got prosecuted.
Now, Chris, these low-end guys, the bottom feeders like Countrywide and New Century, got some reputational smearing, but it was also guys way up in the food chain. The Goldman Sachs and the Lehman's are also intimately involved, right?
Absolutely. This whole thing was a scam. And basically, it was a scam to sell stuff that wasn't and shouldn't have been AAA as AAA-rated securities. So what they did is you had the Countrywides of the world would go out and they would issue billions of dollars worth of very, very dangerous subprime mortgages. And then they would use the securitization process. They used this this sophisticated derivative math to pool all these loans, chop them up into securities, and then they would sell pieces of it as AAA-rated securities. They would first sell all this stuff to banks like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, and then Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs would go around the world. They would go to banks in China and Iceland and Norway. And then they would also sell them to pension funds in California, New Jersey, and Minnesota. And they would say, hey, do you want these AAA-rated securities that have higher rates of return than Treasury bills? And people gobbled it up because they thought it was safe. I mean, AAA-rated means credit risk almost zero. It's supposed to be absolutely safe. But the reality was these AAA-rated securities were actually extremely dangerous mortgage-backed securities. They were blowing up everywhere. They were doomed to blow up. And the banks knew this. I mean, they knew these securities were dangerous, and they sold them with their eyes wide open anyway. And so it was a fraud at every level. The Countrywides were trying to get as many people as they could into these bad loans. And then the Goldmans and the Morgan Stanleys were unloading all this stuff that they knew was deadly as AAA-rated securities to foreigners and pension funds.
Speaking of Goldman Sachs, you have can at least hold your head high of having coined one of the great phrases of our time, because in writing up the latest Goldman earnings report, the Financial Times said, Goldman Sachs or vampire squid, if you prefer.
I know, that's going to be on my headstone now, that phrase. It's really funny. But yeah, they're having some rough times now. You know, Senator Levin last week came out with this big report that essentially accused them of all the stuff I was just talking about a second ago, saying that Goldman, you know, by December of 2007 knew that that mortgage-backed securities were dangerous and likely to default, and they systematically unloaded them on clients while they were betting against them at the same time. So, you know, there were Levin is calling for further prosecutions of Goldman for that, and I think there's an outside possibility that might happen.
But this is a remarkable society, in that, you know, so much of what goes on is thoroughly in the open. We know what criminality was involved. We know how many sick people we've gotten, and we know how many poor people we have. We know just how unequal the distribution of income is. Yet people just shrug their shoulders and take it as a standard operating procedure.
It's really, I think people, there's a fatigue that sets in when you see so much corruption. And you know, you and I talked about this back when I was in Russia and we were talking about, you know, Russian corruption. I think I'm starting to see kind of the same attitude here that you see in the third world, where people no longer are surprised when they find out that about rampant theft that goes on at high levels. And I think there's a lack of outrage now. I mean, it doesn't really, you know, I do these stories, you know, where I expect that people are going to be freaked out, and you know, it just kind of rolls off people's shoulders now because they've seen so much of this stuff that it's just, it doesn't really, you know, excite outrage anymore.
Well, it does with me. All right, thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks so much, Doug. I appreciate it.
That was Matt Taibbi, a reporter for Rolling Stone and author of The Real Housewives of Wall Street in the April 28 issue of that magazine. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with one more from the Mekons. This funeral is for the wrong corpse, a hate poem to capitalism. Till next week. Bye.
You're dead and buried, us out of bone. You clean up the ashes and we light the fire. They're queuing up to dance on socialism's grave. What you call a sane man is now an impotent man. This funeral is for the wrong cause. This is my testimony, a dinosaur's confession. How can someone